100 years ago, agriculture was already changing the landscape of Alaska. Early settlers were testing out gardens in a very new setting. I'm Ann Hillman. This year's Spring Conference of the Alaska Botanical Gardens focuses on the state's historic horticultural history. Our guests today are Alaska Botanical Gardens horticulturalist Ginger Hudson and the garden's executive director, Robin Dublin. They can answer some of your questions about historical plantings and modern gardening on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Alaska Pacific University offers a distinctive, personalized education grounded in hands-on, real-world experience that prepares graduates to be contributing members and leaders in their communities. This message is sponsored by APU. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Welcome to the program. Welcome, Ginger Hudson and Robin Dublin, both from Botanical Gardens. Thank you both for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne.
Today, we'll jump into spring with a conversation on gardening in the past and the present. Listeners, if you have any questions about the history of gardening, please call in. The numbers are 1-800-478-8255, or if you're in Anchorage, 550-8422. You can also submit a comment or a question by email at toa@alaskapublic.org. So, Ginger, let's start with you. One of the big features of the garden this year is a new exhibit designed for the centennial. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, it's the Anchorage Heritage Garden, and it is installed as a tribute to the early settlers of Anchorage, early residents, what they would have grown. So Aisha Gilbert, who is a former board member of the Botanical Garden, has volunteered her time to design an incredible garden that mimics what early residents might have grown in a home garden in a city setting because they had to produce their own food. There weren't shopping centers on every corner in the early part of the 20th century.
So they were mostly food gardens, not ornamentals.
It was a combination. The ladies, of course, loved to have cut flowers in the homes. Cut flowers were a very important part of daily lives in the 18th and 20th, early 20th centuries. But food, definitely. And you can imagine being in a remote state and location such as this, the difficulty in getting fresh food. So once the residents here learned what they could grow and how well to grow it and how big it could be, growing your own food was really important.
That leads me to so many questions. But let's start with, so what does this look like? How do you envision one of the early gardens?
Well, let's see. They generally would have a nice fence around their garden, mostly because of moose, as you can imagine. And the fence did double duty. It served to grow vines. Peas were very important. Sweet peas, snap peas. Peas grow very well here, always a good thing to have in the garden. They were foundations for holding up other lopsided plants, such as sunflowers. Then there would be pathways to the house, and the gardens would be divided into sections of, say, like a cabbage patch, a potato patch, the flowering patch, and possibly if they were able to grow other produce, they might combine flowers that would attract pollinators to those that produce, or they might plant flowers that would distract insects that might eat their produce.
What kind of flowers distract insects?
Well, one of the most popular is the combination of tomatoes and marigolds. Marigolds are a great attractant for insects, and it keeps them away from munching on leaves of other important plants in your garden, such as chard, cabbages, the tomatoes. So this theory is called companion planting. It came into being early to the mid-20th century. I don't know if people quite understood it at the beginning part of the century, but we fully understand that certain plants can be planted in combination that help others thrive or that keep the pests away so that the others will thrive.
When you say came into being, do you just mean like became popular here in Alaska or in general?
Oh, in gardening in general, yes. I would say probably the mid part of the 20th century, people actually started writing about it.
Okay, but it might have been happening before then?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So in this conversation, you keep referring to the woman as being the one who's planting the garden. Was that typically a gendered role at all?
Well, no, it wasn't. And thank you for asking that question. So in the remote parts of the states, when the men were going out to set up their camps for mining, per se, or trapping and hunting, they grew their own food as well. So in the remote bush areas, yes, the men had to plant their own garden. They were out there for months on end. They had to sustain themselves for the whole year. In the city, typically the male would have a job. And what happened when Anchorage was developing was the railroad. And so the men came here for the railroad, or they came here during the war. And so the women tended to the garden.
And then, like, we're talking about the early settlers, so the people who came from the outside. Was there much gardening happening before then? I mean, clearly, clearly they weren't the first people in Alaska.
Yeah, right, clearly.
Yeah.
Well, of course, the original people who live in the state, the indigenous people, harvested all kinds of native plants in addition to wildlife and marine life, and marine plants as well. Then the Russians really were the ones who developed gardening or agriculture in Alaska, probably as we know it, with all their root vegetables, turnips, potatoes, cabbages, onions, garlic, and even tried to bring bees in.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Records show that I have found, and I'm certainly not an expert. I'd refer anybody interested in bees to the South Central Alaska Beekeeper Association. But I have found that bees were brought here as early as 1900, and I want to say in Southeast Alaska. Honeybees. Now, there are native bees, and there are plenty of native pollinators, but we're talking honeybee hives.
Honeybee hives. Okay. Mm-hmm. Robin, why did you guys decide this was an important exhibit to have in the gardens this year?
Well, it was decided several years ago, and part of it was the interest of Aisha Gilbert as a designer who's been involved with the garden for years and has designed a number of different gardens. And the idea was to try and create a garden that would connect people to our heritage in gardening and show us ways to garden now and let the past inform our techniques, but then also inform our choices. And so a lot of the things that are, and Ginger's the person to talk to right now about what plants are in the garden, but the idea that these plants are really vibrant. And so when we created the garden, the other thought was, are there families today that are from families back then who still have plants that they've been gardening? And so we also have plants in the garden that we made a really big concerted effort to collect rhubarb and other plants from people who are getting older and have these plants available. And so the garden also has part of the actual heritage of our gardening experience in Anchorage, and that's pretty exciting. The idea of the Alaska Botanical Garden is to really provide educational opportunities, and it includes research, and research in my mind is not just forward thinking but looking in the past too. And so it's an opportunity for people to see possibilities. And so one of our hopes with this garden is that the Anchorage and Alaska visitor who comes will see and get ideas and learn and have a sense of possibilities for their own property. And of course, for visitors who are coming from outside the state, because we get a lot of visitors from outside Alaska, it's to show them a piece of our past. And to be able to pair that with the centennial is just a wonderful time to do that. We did a soft opening last year to see how things were going, with the idea that this year would be just a really grand, beautiful opening. And we're really excited about this summer and this garden.
Because, Ginger, last year you said you guys grew a test garden, sort of, to see what really does well and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm. We did a trial run. Again, Aisha, the designer, searched high and low and created an incredible list. She interviewed old families, looked at lists at the Agricultural Experiment Station, and she compiled the list of plants that we were to plant. And it was mostly successful. The challenges were some of the flowers were susceptible to the moisture that we have here. Some grew prolifically and we weren't able to keep up with our maintenance. Some we learned that we should direct sow instead of starting in pots earlier and transplanting. They didn't transplant well. And then, of course, we have the unavoidable bear.
Oh, you had bear incidents, I take it?
Yes.
What happened?
The bear discovered our apple trees late in the season, and we have several on the property in different gardens in addition to a crabapple in our heritage garden. But once he was in there, of course, curiosity carries him around, and he found the berries that are growing in the heritage garden, kind of trampled them down a little bit. Fortunately, berries are very hardy, and they'll come back just fine.
Great. I'd like to invite any listeners in to call and have present your questions or comments about things that are working well for you, historical plants you may have. The numbers are 1-800-478-8255 or 550-8422. Robin.
One of the things with bears is that, excuse me, because we're an educational organization, it's really important for us to provide opportunities for people to learn how to garden successfully in Alaska. And so one of the things we're working on right now with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is creating an example of how to really effectively use an electric fence. And it's something that in a typical botanical garden anywhere else, you wouldn't really find that need. But it is possible to have fruit trees in Alaska and have real success with those fruit trees. But you do need to think about how to live with the bears that share this environment that we're in. And so our hope is that that's something that we'll be able to showcase and then also be able to maintain our fruit trees.
And then also my friends have fruit trees growing in their front yard and they have this big fence around it for the sake of moose because they have moose jumping on it. That's also an issue with fruit trees.
It is. For us in particular, the Alaska Botanical Garden has a moose enclosure fence that goes around about 80 of our 110 acres. And so that helps us. Unfortunately, when a moose does get in, it's hard to get them out. But it is something that you do have to consider. The moose enclosure piece is not as confusing to people who are trying to decide how to create that in their yard. But the electric fence is a lot more involved in terms of solar panels and where to get things and how to make it safe and make it work. And so that's something that we want to showcase.
Seems like a good idea. Yeah. Ginger, you were talking a bit about the flowers and you said that some of them it's too moist to grow. Mm. Whenever I talk to people who are gardeners, and I'll just put it out there, I am not a gardener, but people always talk about how Anchorage has all these microclimates and what a difference that makes. Are there things that were blossoming and doing wonderfully for you guys, because you're located over by far north by Centennial, that don't do so well in, say, downtown or up further into the interior of the state?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Because we are in far east and kind of low, it's colder there, so our season starts just a few days later. And there's not the dry air like you get from the heat island effect if you were downtown, where there's constant traffic, there's constant warm air flowing and drying certain flowers love to be dried out. The moisture holding in their foliage at the ground can bring in rot, it can bring in bacteria, it can bring in fungus. That attracts insects. It's a cascading effect. So in a garden like ours or any home gardener, maintenance is key. You want to be out there and clean up all that wet foliage. We had problems with asters being too wet, pansies proliferating. If we aren't able to deadhead them or nip off the heads, they flop and then their flowers are on the ground and they get wet. They're unattractive. Let's see, any other cold and wet. Other than that, our vegetables did great. Chard was champion. Celery was amazing. And carrots and beets, prolific.
That makes a lot of sense. There's We're constantly eating Alaska-grown beets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How did things like the garlic and the onions do?
Garlic did fantastic. In fact, we have been doing ongoing trials of garlic varieties that grow best here, thanks to our former executive director, Julianne McGinnis. And we have found that the garlic in the category of hardneck, porcelain garlic, do the best here in our climate. And those produced fantastic. We are working right now with a student at APU who's doing some more research trials. We have a small research plot at the back of the garden, and we look forward to her results at the end of this summer. So she's taken a small subset of the garlic that was successful, and we're trying more bulbs of each of those to see what happens this year.
Wow. I like how you are looking at the historical past and then using it for research for modern times. Are you trying to use, I've always been told that if you crush up garlic and hot peppers and you put them in water and like spread them on leaves of plants, it keeps away bugs. At least that's how it works in the tropics. Does that work as well here? Have you guys tested that with your garlic?
I would say that works well anywhere. Just about anywhere I have gardened, chili pepper spray can keep ants away. Garlic serves many purposes, not only to ward off certain insects, but fungus as well. It's antifungal, antibacterial. It can help with some kind of mildews. So yes, crushing out garlic is, it's a wonder plant.
and that brings up one point about the Alaska Botanical Garden, which is that several years ago, the board of directors made the decision to be organic. And so it makes our job that much harder, but it allows us to try all sorts of different ways to raise plants in a really sustainable and ecologically friendly way. And then our hope is to really try and promote that kind of gardening and to educate people about different opportunities and techniques. And so some of the things that we do fail. And what I would say to all of our listeners is that many of the things that you do will fail. And that's part of the science of gardening. And then it allows you to get better at your science and your art in your home. So for people out there who are would-be gardeners, don't worry about things dying. You know, try and learn all you can. We have spring conference. We have a website. We're always willing to talk with folks and try and give them insight. And there are a number of wonderful, wonderful gardening clubs that exist in Anchorage and around the state that where you can get great advice, as well as the Cooperative Extension. We partner with them, and they're, if you are into gardening and you haven't called the Cooperative Extension, make sure you do. They're really informative.
And if you're into gardening or you've had experiments in your garden that haven't worked out quite so well or have been beautiful, feel free to call in and let us know. If you're outside of Anchorage, the number is 1-800-478-8255. Or you can call here locally at 550-8422. We have two guests from the Alaska Botanical Gardens. Ginger, one of the things that came up when talking about this historical garden is rhubarb. And I do always think of rhubarb as this amazing Alaska plant. But I don't understand, what do you mean, how you have plants from the original pioneers? Are rhubarbs grown from starts, or how does that work?
Rhubarbs can be divided or just plain dug up and transplanted. And Aisha, in her interviews with families that have been here for generations, found old homes that are still in the families. So, for instance, there's some rhubarb from the Spinard area. There's some from the downtown area. And what she and the previous executive director did were ask the families if they would mind giving us a chunk or giving us a plant so that we can say, yes, look, this has been going on for generations and it lives here and it likes it here and we're going to take advantage of it. It's good food.
Is it different from plant to plant?
There are different varieties of rhubarb. There is the deep red. There's one that's more green. We have two varieties in the garden, and then there's a ornamental variety, a Chinese rhubarb. So it can be different, but the uses, except for the Chinese, which is more ornamental, the uses are the same.
All right, and we do have our first caller on the air, Herman from Antioch. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning. Interesting topic. I'd like to give a few words of experience that I've had out here. I used to be the agricultural director for the K&A farm, and we used to grow just about every kind of vegetables out here. You know, with the long daylight hours and the fertile ground in the big Yukon Kuskokwim Valley, with the proper management, can easily become a produce basket of Alaska. You know, you're talking about all the new technologies. You know, there was one soil and water district. Oh yeah, I used to be a district manager for soil and water conservation district before funding was cut, and we were teaching people to do that. And one soil and water district was teaching people how to use like MRE style of processing food in foil pouches. You know,
really.
And, if they could introduce like freeze dryers in the villages, you know, it would their food could last for like 25 years. One thing we're doing is teach people to use high tunnels to grow different varieties of corn. Growing corn archery is becoming common practice. You know, like for instance, we plant hybrid corn alongside heirloom corn. You know, to produce a variety that can grow out here. I've eaten apples right here in Alaska, grown in trees. People are talking about waste heat generation.
Mm-hmm.
A couple other things. One more comment. There's a guy who just uses carbon sequestration to grow above ground crops. They're like pieces of charcoal. You don't need no other kind of fertilizer. And you're saying about companion planting, but be careful. Don't plant invasive plants that are could damage the environment. But I agree, the potential out here is just enormous for producing vegetables. You know, they're drought in California, and people are having a tough time. You know, if we could bring that back, like root cellars and all these things, people would be easier, be better.
Herman, can you tell me a little bit more about, you were saying, carbon sequestration and growing together?
Yeah, you know, above ground crops like cabbages and kale, they need nitrogen. And when there's charcoal briskets, like they're like charcoal briskets, but they produce nitrogen. That's just about all you need. And I wish one of your hosts there would tell us how else we could grow the underground crops, or what we would need local materials. You know,
like what sorts of things people should be putting in soil to make tubers and other ground crops be more successful?
Yeah, we were in the process of teaching people to use local materials like I used to do a long time ago. I know they used to plant them where their dogs used to be tied, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they used to use ashes and things like that. But
yeah,
kind of bring that back, you know.
Let's toss that question to Ginger. Thanks. That was a great one. Thank you, Herman.
Thank you, Herman. I applaud what you're doing out there. Doing the corn is just amazing because it's wind pollinated and putting it in a high tunnel out in that condition and taking care of it and pollinating it yourself. Boy, that's truly amazing. And you are in a unique opportunity to have the root cellars. Everybody here in the state should have a root cellar and put some stuff away. But anyway, to the organic amendments for your soil. We are so blessed with all the marine life we have here. Fish, any fish waste mixed with your ashes, any other plant material, if you chop up your leftover vegetables or cuttings from your vegetables in the kitchen and mix that all together. I know the cold makes it hard to compost, but a worm bin composter in your house might help. The worms will break down all that material and provide you with a lot of good worm castings for food. But even just putting the bones, the fish bones, into the garden where you're going to garden next year so they can leach all their good benefits out into the soil will be very helpful for the following year's growth.
And Ginger, while we're on the topic of things like compost and using waste to help your gardens grow, I was told about a thing called a food digester, and so we're actually trying it in our backyard. Where basically, like, you take all your food scraps together and you don't try to compost them, but you kind of bury them sort of underground. Do you think it's hot enough for something like that to work in Alaska, or are we just barking up a tree?
I think you'll have a big effort there. No, I definitely do not think the soil or covering compost that way is going to work. We at the garden are actually, another research project we're working on is making our own compost, and we have for several years. We have an expert that helps us turn it. His name's Larry. He's been great working with us for years and years. And Mike Monteruso, our gardens manager, has done a study where he's found that our compost above ground does not get hot enough to kill all the weed seeds. So we're working on that again this year. I mean, we'll work on it every year. We'll just keep doing it until we find a good process. We've compared it to compost produced locally, in addition to covering the bed with mulch to keep those weed seeds from sprouting. So no, I don't think composting in the ground is warm enough.
Okay. We have another caller online, Caroline from Anchorage. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, and thank you for this program. One of the things, I came in a little late on the last gentleman's call, and it's wonderful to know everything that's going on out there. A historical question. Of course, it's not so much a problem up here as it is in the lower 48, but the origin of lawns was, I heard years ago, the aristocracy in both France and England, because if you had wealth, you could show that you didn't have to grow food on your around your home, so you put in lawns. That's one question. Another is, does beer kill slugs? Mm-hmm. And a positive of a volcano eruption I saw in a vacation place down on near Anchor Point years ago, the pansies, you couldn't stop them from growing the year after. And is there a place also where we can see pictures of invasive plants and those that are good to grow here in Alaska? I know that we have something like 23 hot springs in the state, and years ago in the early 80s, I had a tomato fresh grown in Circle Hot Springs, no, excuse me, Manly Hot Springs. This gentleman had a greenhouse heated by the hot spring, and it was the only tomato I've ever had in Alaska that tasted like a tomato. It was just so sumptuous that I was wondering, does anyone have plans of creating commercial tomatoes or something of that nature in Alaska from the hot springs that we have here?
My goodness, those are a lot of great topics. Let's see if I can remember them all. Slugs, yes, beer kills slugs. A great gardening trick is to take a cup, fill it with halfway with beer, bury it in the ground up to the rim, but the cup is exposed, the slugs crawl in it. There you go, bam, you've collected all your slugs overnight.
And does it matter what kind of beer you use?
No.
I think we would say homebrew or beer that was locally crafted.
I don't know, you could do a lot of testing with that. Let's see, a porter versus an IPA, I don't know. Okay, so beer kills slugs, great.
The volcanic ash, yes, a great addition to the garden. In what I hope was a manageable layer, of course, one that just smothers your whole garden isn't going to be good. In fact, gardeners in other parts of the country pay for bags of volcanic ash. So yes, it does add constituents to the garden. Tomatoes and the underground warmth. Yes, Manly Hot Springs and I think Chena Hot Springs mm-hmm. are taking advantage of that. Very smart. There is actually a gardener who will be speaking at our conference this week who talks about holding hot air at the bottom of his greenhouse, a heat sink, in order to continue his growing season. And I would like to encourage you to visit all your local farmers markets because there are some good tomatoes grown here that I find at the farmers markets all summer long, and they do taste good. Yes, that is a benefit. Again, getting back to our heritage and coming back to gardening at home, the food tastes better and it has more nutrients. It's better for you. It's the ground hasn't been just monocultured for year after year after year, and so you have better nutrients in your soil. And the weeds. Invasive plants are a problem. Fortunately, we're far enough away and we have extreme enough climate that they haven't gotten too bad, but the number of weeds coming into the state has increased with the number of people that are able to travel. And so I'd like to refer you to the Anchorage Cooperative Weed Management Area and the USDA and Cooperative Extension here in Alaska or in the Anchorage area. They produce a nice book that talks about all the invasive weeds and why they are not good for us. They take over habitats, they can choke out the native plants, they can degrade stream banks where fish spawn. They make it hard to access lands if there are plants such as Canada thistle that create big thickets and they're stickery and nobody wants to go through them. The bird vetch and taking over the roadsides is choking out our native wildflowers, which is a reason a lot of people come up here. So I do encourage everyone to be careful of what you're planting. And again, to refer back to Herman's question of planting for companions, yes, do not purposely plant invasive plants or alien plants that are going to escape your garden and take over. Thanks for bringing that topic up.
Well, I've participated in the SmackDown, and there's one particular tree that's invasive. Boy, it's hard to get rid of that thing. Every year we go at it, and it's still creating havoc.
This is Robin. Just to add a few comments, in terms of the invasive tree, one thing that I had success with a May tree in my yard that was a monster tree is actually having somebody come and dig out the root. And really, like, we actually had the stump removed, and that seems to really do wonders for those big, determined trees. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of hot springs and take it to people who don't live near hot springs. One of the things that we're investigating, and we can't tell you now, hopefully we'll be able to tell you in the future of what our decision was, but the Alaska Botanical Garden is in the process of researching to raise two greenhouses. And when we put those in, we're looking into geothermal as a way of heating one or both of them. And it's something that a lot of people say, well, you know, we can get natural gas readily now, why do that? And it's looking at what is a long-term way to tap into something that exists readily right next to the place where you want to grow. So I would encourage people to look into geothermal as an option for your greenhouse.
And so using small heat pumps that are just from the ground. So you don't have to be near a geothermal source. You could just use the heat directly from the ground anywhere you are.
That's right. That's right, which seems amazing to me. And then just the other thing, just to add on to what Ginger said, is in addition to the books that are available, there are wonderful photos online. So really do go to that USDA site and the Cooperative Extension site and the other site that she mentioned. And we'll make sure that Anne has all these sites, these web addresses.
We can post them on our website. Yeah. Let's take a quick break before we start taking a few more callers. We already have some online. Thank you so much for calling in, Caroline.
Thank you.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Homestretch premieres on Alaska Public Media Monday, April 13th at 9 p.m. A film about three homeless teens braving Chicago winters, high school pressures, and life on the streets to build a brighter future. Following the film on Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m., will be a statewide online conversation and chat simultaneously engaging with panelists and community members about this film and homeless teens. Details at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're discussing gardening, both in the past and in the present, with Ginger Hudson and Robin Dublin from the Alaska Botanical Gardens. We're taking callers right now. If you have any questions about gardening, want to talk about what you're planting this year, you can call us at 1-800-478-8255 or locally at 550-8422. Now let's take a call from Shelley in Delta Junction. Shelley, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yes, this is a wonderful program. And I wondered, I've been growing a heritage potato now for a few years. And I wondered if, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, the woman from the Heritage Garden has these Klingit potatoes, and or if she knows about them or would like to get some, or anyway.
Ginger, you did tell me a little bit about the Southeast potatoes.
Yes, there are two different potatoes, Klingit and a Haida, and they are just coming out for commercial use. We should be acquiring some this year for test growing. I would refer anybody else who might be interested to look at the Cooperative Extension Service or maybe the Plant Materials Center in Palmer, but they're not widely available just yet. However, we did sample them this year. Every year, the Cooperative Extension Service hosts a potato bash, and we cook up potatoes grown in Alaska by Alaska farmers and do taste tests. And they were included this year, so it was really exciting to see it get its recognition.
Okay, yeah, good, because they're actually, there's some more to the story of those, the Klingit potatoes. They're being studied by a researcher. I'm actually searching right now for that link, which I can't find. This was covered in the Juneau and Sitka papers back in 2009. A researcher is using the DNA from those potatoes to try to trace trade links. And he's officially named these one group of Klingit potatoes from Haines as Maria's potatoes, after Maria Ackerman. But because those, anyway, I got my strain from Maria's daughter. And I've been growing them now and passing around seedlings, seeds, and so we've been spreading these Klingit potatoes around the state.
And are they, Shelley, are they doing well up in Delta Junction? I mean, the climate in Delta is very different than it is in Haines.
Oh, potatoes do wonderfully here. And yes, they're doing well. They're not big. You know, they're fingerlings. And last year we had such a cold and rainy summer that some people I gave them to said they were only the size of marbles, but I've been growing them now for about 4 years, and I can get some pretty good sized fingerlings, and I think we planted 25 plants summer before last and got like 45 pounds of potatoes.
Oh,
yeah, so they do real well up here if we have a decent summer.
All right,
well, people can find links by looking up. Maria's potatoes in Haines. So there's an article in the Sitka News, and the one is from the Juneau Empire. It's so old. I think I'm not able to find it.
That's all right. I'm sure that people who are interested are already starting to do some of their own research. Thank you so much for calling in, Shelley.
Sure. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. And while we're on the topic of food. Let's go to Robin just for one moment.
I just wanted to say, you know, people say, you know, why a heritage garden? Why now? And one of the things about that, it goes exactly to what this caller was talking about, which is the idea that back then there were concerns about food, and now we have a lot of conversations about food security and the idea that in Anchorage and in Alaska we are so reliant on outside food. And across the country, the slow food movement, the idea that you want food that is locally grown, that you have control over and you can access, really, to me, hits home in who we are as Alaskans. And so that self-determination is, I think, part of why a heritage garden, why now, besides the fact that it is the centennial anniversary in Anchorage, and that's a thing that we are a part of and we receive funding for and we're really excited about celebrating. But really, I think when you think about food, it really is fundamental to us, and to be a botanical garden that focuses both on, you know, beautiful plants for enjoyment and inspiration and also food, because that's something that sustains us in another way, I think is pretty exciting.
All right. We have another caller online. Douglas is calling in from Petersburg. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm not necessarily a gardener per se, but I do live in a third floor apartment with crummy plumbing. I was doing research and I came across Bokashi, which is basically anaerobic composting, using microbes to basically pickle just about any solid food waste.
Oh.
And even pet waste as well. And assuming you get a system that works properly, I'm having troubles with the system I bought, but assuming you get a system that works properly, it's supposed to take, take a 5-gallon bucket worth and break it down to about half the volume in 2 weeks, which you can then throw into a worm bin or bury, et cetera. But then you can at least pre-compost year-round.
Oh, and does it use heat, or do you have to put in additives?
No, it's completely anaerobic. If you Google Bokashi, you see the system.
Okay.
But it uses beneficial microbes and basically digests solid waste, fats, meats, bone, a bunch of stuff you can't throw in traditional compost, but it still breaks it down. And then once you're done with that, compost pile it or worm bin, whatever. But that's another way to do year-round disposal.
That's really good advice for people who are living in apartment situations and who don't have land to build their own compost piles.
Yeah. The trick is you got to have somewhere for the remnants to go to, but you know, my mom has a compost pile, so when I have a load done, I can get it to her, but you know.
All right.
Worm bin's also another idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jim.
Here I am going in circles, but anyway, Bokashi.
Bokashi. All right. Well, thank you for your input, Douglas. I'm glad you called in.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Thank you for your efforts, Douglas. Yeah, it just goes to show no matter what size home or apartment or efficiency or where you live, you can compost. Just be sure that you are doing it correctly and that you are allowing that compost to completely compost so you're not spreading any pathogens back to yourself or to anybody's garden.
Mm-hmm. I've read about similar things, kind of what I was talking about before with the food digester, where you can put in pet waste and all of these things, and it uses the heat to break it down. And then instead of storing the nutrients back into compost that you can use, there's holes in the bottom of the like trash can or whatever you're using that seeps back into the ground, and then the worms get in at the same time. So researching compost is definitely an interesting thing, and learning from others what they've had work here in Alaska has been great.
There are a lot of opportunities through, we've mentioned the Cooperative Extension and Botanical Garden, but there are a lot of other folks around who do education on composting as well. And it's something that really anyone can do. And if you don't, you know, like Douglas, if you don't have a garden, that doesn't mean that material is not really beneficial to somebody else. And finding somebody who would want your compost is not that hard to do. There are a lot of people out there who would be really thrilled to get great compost from you.
And speaking of things that we save in addition to compost, we also save seeds. And you guys have done a lot of work with seed-saving projects. Ginger, what's the importance of saving heirloom seeds?
You know the source, first of all. And if it is a variety that you like, that produces well, that tastes good, it came from your family, it came from a known source, that is the number one benefit. When we began the process of hybridizing, cloning, copying, crossing, mixing breeds, you develop for things that you like, color, aroma, but sometimes you might lose nutrients or stamina. And so saving seeds that have produced well for you or purchasing seeds from places that have harvested sustainably or carefully and know the source of their seed is a great benefit to not only your health, but the health of the environment as well.
It's also a matter of biodiversity, the idea that over time, as a collective, all of us are making sure that the different specific seeds are available not just now but well into the future. And the Botanical Garden has been involved in a project with in C Collection, and that was so that with Q, which is a botanical garden in London. And so all over the country, there are 13 institutions that are working with Smithsonian on orchid seeds, and we're also doing other collections that we're sending to seed banks. And the seed banks have very specific protocols, and they make sure that this collection is available for future generations. And so to me, that's really exciting when we think about things like climate change and invasive plants coming into an area, that the fact that we and all sorts of other gardens are trying to collect and store seeds for the future is, we get heirloom from the past and we can save those for the future.
Great. And now we're going to take another caller. We have Pauline online from Big Lake. Pauline, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. I have a greenhouse that I've been growing tomatoes for many years, and now it doesn't, I don't get ripe tomatoes like at, when we start getting silver salmon.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, does it need to have a rest time? Because I amended with fish fertilizer, mostly fish fertilizer.
And you're asking, like, are you asking if there's a certain amount of time you need to wait to plant in an area before?
No. You know, I was thinking to give it a rest. Does it need to rest, or can I just amend it? And I mean, what's the theory behind resting your garden? What does it do to rest it?
Well, Pauline, tomatoes are very nitrogen hungry, so they take a lot of that nutrient out of the soil. And commonly what people do when they're growing plants in this family, tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, is they'll alternate where they plant them year after year. So the year after you had tomatoes in a spot, the next year you want to plant something rich in that puts nitrogen back in the soil, like peas, alfalfa, things of that nature, and move the crops around. Because also, if you keep growing tomatoes in the same place, not only are they taking all the nutrients that they want, there could be pests or insects or bacteria or fungus that are going to hang out there with the tomatoes because they figured out, oh, these guys are here year after year. So while you may not have those pests right now, that could develop into a problem. But I would say rotate around. Maybe find a different spot for your tomatoes every year and plant something different in that spot. That gives you the opportunity to grow something else yummy.
Okay. So what kind of nutrients does fish have? Is it only, it doesn't include nitrogen?
Fish provide magnesium. They provide phosphorus. They are not heavy in the nitrogen. When they break down, they do help release nitrogen in the soil, but something that a legume that makes that nitrogen nodule in the soil is going to put better nitrogen into the soil. I'm not saying don't stop with the fish, because they provide all kinds of good nutrients. So keep putting your fish in the soil, but try putting your tomatoes in a different spot every year.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Pauline. We're going to go for a quick break before we take on some more callers on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast offers online degree programs in business, human resources, and management, including the skill set required by Alaska's growing industries. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Welcome back. Today on Talk of Alaska, we're discussing gardening past and present. And now we have a caller online from Valdez, Harold from Valdez. Thanks you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. This is such a big topic, so little time. I have a quick question, I hope, about annelids, segmented worms themselves. Are they not invaders? I've been watching a population of what I used to call down the lower 48 night crawlers for 8 years up at 2,500 feet in the Chugach Mountains. And I don't know whether to exploit them or eliminate them because they are invasives. And if you have time, could you also touch on using copper for getting rid of slugs? And also another invasive are the beneficial nematodes that people import annually. Those will probably die in the soil. But the worms themselves have established a breeding population. I'm just curious about that. Should we exploit them or eliminate them as invasives? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Wow, Harold, good point. Yeah, the night crawlers are invasive. I am not an expert on what we should do to get rid of them. Again, I'd probably refer you to the Cooperative Extension Service. And the beneficial nematodes, you're right on those. They will probably die away in our soil because of the temperature. They're more temperate climate. Good bacteria, though, or nematode. And
Copper.
Copper for slugs. Yes, exactly. So earlier we had the question about beer for slugs. Copper for slugs, strips. The slugs don't like to cross the strips, and so that keeps them away from your plants, and it's permanent. There are other remedies for slugs, such as salt and sluggo and diatomaceous earth. Those last three are items that have to be reapplied after a rain, so the copper is definitely a good barrier demarcation line for slugs.
So would you just put strips of like old wires on top of your soil, or would you nail it to the edge of raised beds, or?
No, you want it on the soil surrounding the plant, and it's sold in a flat strip. A copper wire might work, but it's fairly narrow, and these strips are quarter to a half inch wide, and so it's more of a physical and chemical or electromagnetic barrier they don't like to cross.
This might sound a little ridiculous, but could you put a whole bunch of pennies around your plants? Like if you had a giant jar of pennies, I'm just thinking, saving money.
Yeah, well, saving money and spreading money. That's a good question. Hey, somebody out there, try that and tell us if it works. But I will remind you that pennies are not solid copper. It's copper on top of the zinc. So, it would be a fun experiment.
All right. Well, now I know what to do for my next science project. Great. Let's bring another caller online. We have Ken, who is calling in from Homer. Welcome to the program.
Okay. Thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you very much for the program. We're talking about slugs. I just want to say from my experience, long years of raising chickens, the small home flock, right now we've got about 5-6 chickens, and they're clearing out an area 30 by 50, which we've got gill net over the top of, so we'll drop gill net down for the summer and get in and rototill it. But the chickens are quite effective at turning the soil. They keep all the wheat seeds out, and the slugs. I haven't had a single slug in my potatoes since we did that. The carrots come in about twice the size of the carrots, say, in a raised bed, which is forced manure for fertilizer. And that's all I wanted to toss in the mix here. And thank you again so much for the program.
Thank you very much for calling in. Chickens, raising chickens in your garden. Mm-hmm. Have you guys tried that at all at home or elsewhere?
Not personally. Ken, that's a great idea, though. Yeah, eating the bugs. Chickens are great for eating the insects. And I've seen quite a few around Alaska.
Chickens are becoming very popular.
Yeah.
Fresh
eggs. Hey, why wouldn't you want to have them? You do have to take care of them in the winter, so remember that expense. But hey, for your health and fresh eggs.
Sounds good. So people have been talking a lot about insects here. But there's also a lot of positive insects, right? And you mentioned earlier that bees are native to Alaska and that there's all sorts of other pollinators. Mm-hmm. Ginger, can you talk about pollinators that are native to the state and how we can encourage them to come to our gardens?
Yes, there are a lot of native pollinators, pardon me. Butterflies, moths, hummingbirds, birds, wasps, flies, midges, fungus, gnats, beetles, and mosquitoes. Yes, they serve a purpose here. The male mosquito is the pollinator, flies around from flower to flower, drinking nectar and transferring pollen grains. Butterflies, moths, we all know. So make sure you're planting plants that attract and provide food for these critters so they can keep proliferating, because we all know the food chain. We want the plants pollinated, the birds want to eat the insects, the fish want to eat the insects, the mammals want to eat the birds and the fish, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a vast array of insect pollinators here, and recently new varieties of bats being discovered in Southeast. I think there are up to 4 different species of bats in the state.
But wait, bats are pollinators?
Bats are pollinators. In addition to eating insects, so another consumer of the insects, why you want to keep mosquitoes around to feed the bats. Bats also travel from flower to flower for nectar. So,
Wow.
There are plants that bloom at night in addition to plants that bloom in the day.
All right. So we've talked about pollinators. We've talked about invasive species. Another thing that comes up often is talking about what kind of seeds you use in terms of hybrid seeds or genetically modified seeds. Are there issues with hybrids or genetically modified ones in terms of attracting natural pollinators or other issues?
That is probably a question for some big scientific nerd people. I think the jury is still out on the GMOs, we're not sure of. But as I mentioned earlier, as we get into crossbreeding and creating new varieties, it changes the attributes of the plant. So the pollinator or the animal that eats it may not recognize it as the original plant they had in their lineage.
All right. I'd like to thank you both very much for being here today. We had on the program Ginger Hudson and Robin Dublin from the Alaska Botanical Gardens. They're having their spring conference coming up later this week, starting on April 10th. Thank you all for everyone who called into the program. This is Talk of Alaska Statewide. I'm Ann Hillman, and this is the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.